for Pauline. I do not find it so easy to talk about my father. I have yet to find a biography of him that satisfies me as a picture of the whole man. The emphasis is so much on what he did that few people know what he was. I have been astonished at times to find the general impression is that he was a sort of superhuman lightning rod, pulling down inventions from heaven at will, a miraculous robot who never got tired, a disembodied brain whose success, bringing fabulous riches, was effortless and assured, in spite of a background of abject poverty, almost total lack of education, and no personal life at all. I may say that the picture is not quite accurate. Madeline Edison Sloan. Prologue, 1931. Toward the end, as at the beginning, he lived only on milk. When he turned 84 in February and pretended to be able to hear the congratulations of the townspeople of Fort Myers, and let 20 schoolgirls in white dresses escort him under the palms to the dedication of a new bridge in his name, and shook his head at being called a genius by the governor of Florida, and gave a feeble whoop as he untied the green and orange ribbon, and retreated with waves and smiles to the Riverside estate he and Mina co-owned with the Henry Fords. He declined a slice of double-iced birthday cake, and instead drank the fourth of the 7 pints of milk, warmed to nursing temperature, that daily soothed his abdominal pain. From earliest youth he had half-starved himself, faithful to the dictum of the temperance philosopher Luigi Cornaro, 1467 to 1566, that a man should rise from the table hungry. It was not always a matter of choice. At times during his teenage years as a gypsy telegrapher, he had wandered the streets of strange cities, unable to afford a cheekful of tobacco. But even in early middle age, while earning big money and enabling 2 successive wives to fatten on haute cuisine, he would eat no more than 6 ounces a meal, generally only 4, and drink nothing except milk and flavored water. A man can't think clearly when he's tanking up. His one indulgence was cheap Corona cigars, which he smoked, or rather chewed, by the boxful, and liked not for their price, but for their strong, coarse taste. These long toms jazzed his already hyperactive metabolism to the point that he could work 54 hours at a stretch. Until about 2 years ago, he had habitually run up flights of stairs and could swing a spry leg over his desk. Long before that, his stomach had shrunk so much that anything more than a lamb chop or a couple of fish balls made him feel sluggish. At 77, he reduced his daily diet to a slice of toast, a tablespoon of porridge, another of spinach, a sardine, and 4 Unita biscuits washed down with pint after pint of milk. At 81, he switched to milk entirely, except for a quarter of an orange at either end of the day. Now he was afflicted by a toxic mix of renal failure and diabetes. Famously indestructible, having near blinded himself with the study of incandescence, suffered countless acid burns and electrical shocks, bombarded his arms and face with Rentgens, and breathed enough mine dust to give a lesser man pneumoconiosis, he seemed at last to be in final decline, along with the national economy, about $15 billion of which derived from his inventions. "My message to you," he advised his fellow citizens in a valedictory radio broadcast from his botanical library, "is to be courageous. I have lived a long time. I have seen history repeat itself time and again. I have seen many depressions in business. Always America has come back stronger and more prosperous." Before returning home at winter's end to New Jersey, he prayed to some power other than God, whose existence he denied, to be spared long enough to finish his current round of botanical experiments. "Give me 5 more years, and the United States will have a rubber crop that can be utilized in 12 months' time." It was clear, however, when he arrived at the station in Newark, that he would not see another spring. He was frail and stooped under his thick fall of